Welcome to Mission Daily. Today, Chad is joined by Carrie Palin, Chief Marketing Officer at Splunk, where she is in charge of all things marketing. Prior to joining Splunk, Carrie served as the CMO of SendGrid and was the first CMO at Box, a cloud content management company. Carrie also served as the VP of Marketing for IBM's Cloud Data Services and Analytics Software Division. On this episode, Carrie joins us to discuss her career experiences and the leadership lessons she has learned along the way, as well as how to succeed as a new CMO and what to do when you're a leader in an organization that's being acquired. Mission Daily is created by our team at mission.org.
Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I'm excited to have you here. I would love to start kind of at the beginning. So if you'll humor me, let's go back to the beginning. Where'd you grow up and where are you from?
Yeah, so my dad was actually in tech when it wasn't cool back in the 60s and 70s. And so we were a little bit of corporate gypsies moving around between Minneapolis, Boston, Massachusetts, Dallas, Austin, but settled in Austin. So I spent the bulk of my formative years there. So I consider myself an Austinite.
It's a great place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any fond memories from the Austin area? Any formative experiences in Texas that you could share?
It's all sports all the time where I come from. So
okay,
two
cool.
NFL Super Bowl quarterbacks went to my high school. So I grew up just eyeball deep. If I wasn't playing sports, I was watching sports,
right,
which is very Texas of me, I know. but also I was raised by two Midwesterners who are just crazy, low-key and pragmatic, both grew up in farm country, self-made. So they always kept us grounded. So I never got the kind of everything is bigger in Texas thing happening in our house because they always kept us honest and never too overblown for our skis. And it was great. Austin was a wonderful place to grow up in. For sure.
Very cool. And when you were thinking about planning your exit or your next exploration, what was kind of on your radar at that point? And when did you decide to leave Austin?
Yeah. So I left for college and came back right afterwards. I started my career at Dell in marketing. Actually, to be clear, I started in PR, internal PR. And within 3 months, they moved me into a assistant brand manager role in marketing. And that's where my marketing career started.
Very
sort
cool.
of haphazardly. They didn't ask me. They just put me and there I went. And I started furiously reading marketing books because I was so scared that I didn't know what I didn't know. So anyhow, that started there. And then I spent, you know, over the course of 20 years and 17 of them at Dell. And I woke up one day and my husband looked at me and he said, "Hey, are you going to be a lifer at Dell?" And it never even occurred to me because Dell was so much the anchor of Austin and they were so great at developing you in your career. So I had a new job every 18 months. And when he asked me that, I thought, oh my God, like, am I going to be a lifer at Dell? I hadn't even really thought about it. And then ironically, a couple weeks later, two recruiters called at the same time for roles at IBM and at Ericsson. And I ended up wanting to go to IBM because I was leading marketing for what they call a small startup inside of IBM. But it was basically how to port all their on-prem software to SaaS and offer it on Bluemix, which was their platform that was competing with AWS. And so I got to work for a 42-year-old founder, SaaS entrepreneur for a year and some change. And it was wonderful. I learned a ton.
Very cool.
Got out of Hardwareville, learned about SaaS. And then IBM reorged and Box came calling. And I thought, okay, maybe we make a leap to the Valley. And, you know, there was a little trepidation going from big corporate to working for a 31-year-old founder CEO. But my husband and I just decided, you know, if you don't take a little risk in life, it's pretty boring. So let's give this a whirl. We kept our house in Austin just in case it didn't land. But a year later, we sold it because it turned out to be the best move of my career.
Very cool. And I think what I'd like to focus on throughout your story is some of the leadership lessons that you learned, whether you were learning them from others or where you were kind of like implementing them. I would love to hear about, like, you know, early results at Dell and what you learned there. So Dell is really fascinating for a number of reasons. So we just started working with them and it was shocking for me to see how kind of like on the cutting edge they are. So they do integrated product placements and try to be in movies and all kinds of media. It's really exciting. So, you know, you mentioned that every 18 months you were getting a new position, a new job. What was that culture like there? And what were some leadership lessons you took away from your time at Dell?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Whenever I speak in a professional manner externally, I always talk about the fact that I'm an amalgamation of all the great mentors and leaders that I've worked under over the course of my career. And many of them came from my days at Dell. And so, and interestingly, almost all of them were exclusively men and most of them white men. So, you know, in this day and age where I am a big proponent of diversity, I always have been, but like it's now in the front and center of everybody's vernacular and diversity and inclusion at every company and what have you. I will tell you, my career would not be where it is today without some amazing male mentors and advocates and allies throughout my career. So that's one. So there are some really incredible people there. Dell also hired some amazing people there. You know, interestingly, Dell has been able to attract great talent because for a long time, they're sort of ahead of the game in disrupting markets, even though they weren't built on IP necessarily as a company, but also because they were the game in town in Austin, Texas. And anybody who wanted to live in Austin and knew about what a secret it was back 20 years ago and wanted to remain there typically stayed at Dell. So they're able to retain talent. It wasn't the same, like the Valley where everybody moves around.
Right.
And so they built this culture of family that was pretty special. When I finally left Dell, the hardest part was leaving the amazing people there. And as far as the leadership lessons go, I will tell you, number one, results matter. We used to joke at Dell that if you were sweeping the floors, you needed to know where the P&L was at that day in the quarter. If one of our GMs walked by and asked you, I mean, it was just, we were such a P&L driven culture. And so I learned about operational excellence and reliance on data before data science and data analytics were actually something that were sexy. Dell was eyeball deep in data at all times. And we knew the numbers, we understood our business, regardless of what role we played. And I will always appreciate that from a corporate culture standpoint, but also my mentors taught me about that. And it propelled my career because I became a data-driven marketer when most marketers weren't.
Right.
And all of a sudden, it became very in vogue. And then I had a set of skills that were relatively unique as a leader that fast-tracked my career. So I'm greatly appreciative for that. I also will tell you that as a leader, it becomes so much less about you as it does about your people. And so curating the best team possible every single day is my number one job. And I think the lesson I've learned over the years is that if you lose sight of that, even for a nanosecond, you've missed it. So going back to my Texas sports kind of roots, I always say that my number one job is putting the right team on the field, but the right team captains matter most. Because as they go, so the rest of the team goes. And we, our job is to enable every single member of my team to come and do their very best work every day and feel safe and included and able to bring their best version of themselves. And then all boats rise and everyone wins. But that means that it's not just a rah-rah. That means making hard decisions.
Sure.
And so when we talk to leaders about like, what does that look like? Well, to me, the number one priority is curating the fringes of your org. So looking after your highest performers and highest potential folks in a way that's meaningfully different than the rest of the pack. And then also the folks who aren't pulling their weight. And, you know, I'll give you an example. You have people who don't show up to work for weeks on end, and they're posting on social outlets that they're doing something other than work, but they're drawing a paycheck, and yet they're friends with half your org on social media. People know that kills morale, right? So you've got to stay on top of that stuff to make sure that if somebody's not happy and they're not performing well, that you're immediately in the weeds with them, figuring out what's the right solution there.
Right.
So you don't have the rest of your org flailing because they see that you allow that as a leader and you're not taking care of the people who are busting their butts for the organization. Right. So there's a lot implied in that, but it's a lot of work and it's every day.
Yeah. And I think what you mentioned about the foundation of that culture revolving around data and the P&L is fascinating because, you know, if the P&L doesn't look good, none of us have opportunity, right? The opportunity pie isn't going to expand for everybody if we're not focused on data and the P&L. So when you first encountered that data culture and that maniacal focus on the P&L, how'd you react to that, right? Where, did you think, oh, this is a culture about money? Or did you think, no, there's something deeper going on here?
No, for me, it was as the success of the company goes, so goes our personal success. And so waking up every day and thinking about how I can help drive the P&L better for Dell, maybe think about the fact that that will enable our stock price and everybody will be happier because we can afford college educations for our kids and the house we want to live in and all those things that matter outside of work that allow for you to be your best self. And even if it's time off to go run marathons, whatever that is. But when the company's healthy, stress is lower, people are happier, it just all kind of plays together. So for me, I loved becoming data-driven in that capacity. And as MarTech has advanced and we are able in data science and data analysts, like we are able to actually get our hands on as marketers, compelling data that actually threads the needle all the way through to revenue that is marketing source, marketing influenced, and in a way that is org function neutral between all the go-to-market functions. And it's really been an exciting time to be a marketer, especially in the last like 8 years because of all of these changes and advancements in marketing from a technology standpoint.
Yeah, it's definitely an exciting exciting time. But I'm curious to know, what type of sports did you play? And let's start there.
So I grew up with a brother and in a neighborhood of all boys, an older brother. So, and I'm tall, which you can't tell from listening to a podcast. I'm 5'10". So I played a lot of volleyball. I played basketball. And then I also was... And this is a funny one, but I was a competitive cheerleader that like was on the national cheerleading championships every year. So
not easy to get to nationals.
That's, No. I mean, people don't realize that it's an actual sport, but it is. Yeah. And it was a lot of fun. But I think in general, sports just taught me a lot about resilience. You know, it, when you get your butt kicked, how do you get back up the next day and work harder?
Sure.
And excellence and working together, most importantly. Just some foundational skills that have played very well in my adult life that I'm so grateful to have gotten at that age.
Very cool. And let's shift gears a moment to your time getting ready for the move out here to Box. Mm-hmm. So at the time, Box was not post IPO. It was still kind of early days. And I think across your tenure, Box revenue doubled with you as the CMO, to lead that team. I'd be curious to know, you know, what was that like getting ready to join? And then what was that experience like?
Yeah. So it's a really actually funny story. Back to the 31-year-old founder. And we actually had gone public right before I joined.
Oh, my fault.
So no big deal, but just a minor nit just to kind of lay the groundwork. But sure. Box had their first bad quarter since going public. Not bad, but not awesome.
Right.
And so I interviewed for 3 months, and I usually would fly out here on Sundays in the morning and fly back on Sunday nights. And I'd do hours with the CEO and other people. And then he'd give me homework for my flight home. I'd send it to him that night at 1 a.m. when I'd land or whenever it was. And he'd get back to me a few days later. And it was a classic Silicon Valley sort of grinder through, because I had never actually done a public company CMO role, right?
Sure.
And he really was trying to figure out how to solve for some things. And a lot of things were broken within the marketing org at that time. And to no one's fault, but they hadn't had a CMO in over a year and things were sideways and they weren't able to measure things and they didn't have the right MarTech stack. And so it was just, they had never run a true tier one campaign in market, like just basic fundamentals of blocking and tackling. So we had a lot to kind of figure out if I was right for them, if he was right for me and that culture.
Sure.
And we finally just kind of sat down when we decided to do this thing, and he and the COO, Dan Levin, whom I adore, and Dan was my direct line manager. You need to give me lots of feedback because I thrive on feedback. So give me the guardrails and tell me when I'm making decisions that you're not happy with or supportive of, and, you know, guide me as far as I'm ramping into Box, but let's go do this thing. And so my husband and I took a deep breath and dove into the deep end of the pool, and away we went. And we're now actually buying a house in Silicon Valley and putting roots down, which is crazy 3 years later to say
that's great.
But
congrats.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I'm curious, what does your husband do and how was that move for him? Because, you know, taking a CMO role, I'm sure time wasn't like, you didn't have a lot of time at that point, right? So
no.
What was that like for him? And
Yeah, he's amazingly bright and is definitely my better half, but he's an entrepreneur and takes risks that make my skin crawl. You know, he likes to swing for the fence and I like to work for the man. So it's all good. But he had just sold his company in Texas right before we moved. So it was a perfect time.
Perfect timing.
And so he had a little bit of time to help our kids and me and kind of be available to get settled. And he's off to his next venture right now, kind of standing up another company.
At Box, you mentioned they had never done like a tier one campaign or anything like that. You know, what was your first 90 days like there? Or what was the first campaign maybe you put together and launched?
Yeah. So first 90 days, huge listening tour. Doesn't matter where I go. You don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And you really need to listen at every level of the organization and every stakeholder. You can learn a lot, right? By using your ears and your mouth in the same proportion that God gave them to you.
Sure.
And so that was that. I will tell you that, you know, the morale was pretty low at that time with marketing. And that concerned me the most, because when you want to retain your talent and also build and attract talent as the number one job of a CMO, you have to get into that immediately and earning trust faster than a normal clip. And so we had a very open, good culture as a company. Marketing struggled as a subculture of that culture. And so I worked on that primarily with the team, and then also making moves on the leadership team to kind of get the right team captains in place. And then we immediately kind of sat down and we were going through a brand reimagination at the time. So when I got there, we were calling ourselves the modern content platform. And frankly, it just fell flat. Like, customers didn't understand what that was. We were owning our space at the time, which was the content collaboration space where the Dropboxes and Microsoft OneDrives play. But we also had such an advanced feature set that we were eating away at enterprise content management. So classic, like OpenText, Documentum, that type of thing. And the world didn't know about it. So we were trying to reinvent ourselves at this juncture of those two categories where we believed the puck was going in the market, but they hadn't gone yet. And I will tell you, the AR team there that I was lucky enough to inherit did a masterful job at getting the Gartners and Forresters of the world to believe in that and move that direction with us kind of leading the charge. And we went this whole category rebuild where we called ourselves cloud content management. And so it took a while for us to kind of all convince each other that cloud content management implied that it was something very modern, but that we could draft off of a larger market that CIOs understood, that they have a budget line item for, right? Because modern content platform was something that no one had a budget line item for, right? And it makes the job of our salespeople so much harder when they go to market. So it ended up landing really, really well. And the team did an amazing job. And I, you know, give all credit to them because they were amazing. Our brand team and our content team and our product marketing team just really, you know, kind of put it all out there. And it has landed really well for Box.
It seems like adding that one word of cloud can help tee up salespeople to start talking about security and all the reasons why enterprises buy, right?
Totally.
Have you noticed that throughout your career that like small tweaks to existing campaigns or ideas can make huge results?
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. I think sometimes, honestly, as marketers, we tend to over-rotate on creativity. And we sometimes just confuse folks when we're trying to be too cute. I think sometimes being very simple and hammering the market with a very simple message that people already have a headspace for, but maybe just a small tweak to it is radically important, especially when you don't have the budgets of Microsoft or Amazon to go push into market, right? I mean, Azure is a success and Cortana is a success because Microsoft has zillions of dollars to throw at marketing campaigns to get the market educated on that. But the Boxes of the world don't have that. And Splunk doesn't have that level of marketing investment either. We have a decent amount, but you need to be able to draft off of big themes in market so that you can get broader play.
So what was that transition from Box to SendGrid to Splunk like? Because I know it was all, it's all pretty recent, right? So you joined Splunk in February, you were at SendGrid prior to that. What was that transition like?
So I left Box after 2.25 years or so, and it was a great run and I loved it, but I was ready for my next adventure when SendGrid came calling. And I'm a big believer you work for people. Loved working for Dan Levin and Aaron Levy. Loved it. I really fell in love with, in a professional way, in a non-creepy professional way, with Samir Dholakia, who is the CEO of SendGrid. He's just an amazing guy and probably one of the best leaders in the Valley. And when I met with him, I thought, yeah, I could learn from this guy. And I've got so much to learn still. But also marketing owned about 90% of the revenue at SendGrid. So it was all Discover Tribuy, which was part of our portfolio at Box and a big portion of IBM, but it was wholesale marketing owned revenue. So it changed the dynamic of what my role was, even though it was a smaller company, it was still public and growing 30%+ year over year. So it was functioning well, but it was needing its sort of next step in growth. And a month into being there, Twilio announced their intent to purchase us, which was awesome. Twilio is a fantastic company. I have nothing but respect for where they're going and their leadership team. But I knew that over time, my role would change once we were acquired, which I stayed through the acquisition, which I was happy to do. But the day that was announced, Splunk called, and I wasn't ready to talk yet. But when I was, everything fell into place. I wasn't looking to leave. But when I think when the magic happens and like things, literally everything falls into place and there are no concerns, you know you're in the right place. And so,
So if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to go into some more detail about, you know, what that handoff was like and what the process of you kind of like, you know, as CMO of SendGrid, passing off the reins or whatever you want to call it to Sarah and then transitioning out, because, you know, obviously it's kind of bittersweet. You're leaving after the acquisition. How do CMOs go about that? And any tips for CMOs that are, you know, currently going through an acquisition or career change?
Leave your ego at the door, number one. When you're being acquired, number two, remember that. Like, this wasn't a merger. This was an acquisition. And Twilio was incredibly gracious through our acquisition and treated us more like a merger. But the reality was, it wasn't about me. It wasn't about making sure that we kept everything in a capsule and didn't touch it. The reality was we needed to do what was right for the greater good. And so I will tell you, Sarah Varney's just outstanding. I have so much respect for her and I'm so happy. She was someone I was happy to give my team to, essentially. And I know that she's taken good care of them already and will only take them to the next step. So that allowed for me to put on my team hat and not think about it as SendGrid versus Twilio. It was what's the greater good. And also my team's thrilled to work for her. So it was an easier transition than normal, but check your ego at the door. Think about what's right for the greater good, right? I mean, the reality is at some point, after an acquisition, it's very rare that brands stay separate and there isn't a brand lockup between the two. And so think about what's going to drive the greater company forward, back to sort of those Dell lessons. It's about how do you, especially when you're publicly traded, right? Mm-hmm. How do you deliver to Wall Street? They're expecting when you do a big acquisition. And for Twilio, SendGrid was a big acquisition at the time. I think it was maybe the third or fourth largest all stock transaction ever in tech. Like, it was significant. And I remember sitting in the room when Samir and Jeff Lawson were speaking with financial analysts right at their customer event at Signal. And half the analysts were like, Samir, why in God's name would you sell right now? You guys are growing over 30% year over year. You're profitable. You know, the rule of 40 applies. Like, you guys are kicking ass. Why would you do that? In the same time, the other half of the room were looking at Jeff and saying, we think you overpaid for this company. Why'd you do that? And
balance to strike.
Right. But at the end of the conversation, after an hour, just about every analyst was like, I get it.
Yeah.
And it was so beautiful to see that transformation in the course of an hour. And I believed, too, that it was really the right thing for both companies.
Right.
And so when you do feel that way, it's easy to behave in a way that's right by that every day. And so on day one, even though it wasn't originally the plan, a third to a half of my team moved under Sarah immediately. And that was the right decision.
Wow. Yeah.
So and ultimately, most of them will move over as the transitions occur. But there is a need for keeping something separate because SendGrid does monetize online and Twilio, for the most part, monetizes offline. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, getting all that MarTech and websites to integrate. It's non-trivial.
Let's talk about Splunk for a moment, because I would love to get your kind of like philosophy or your mental models that you were using for how you evaluated this opportunity, because Splunk is exciting. It's a very technical product, but the room that Splunk has to grow is substantial in the market. So how are you looking at that opportunity and what made you really excited about joining?
Yeah, it's funny. I won't mention names, but a couple of hot companies that have gone IPO this year called at the same time Splunk did. And they were awesome. And I was so thrilled that they called, but I knew immediately that Splunk was where I wanted to be. And the reason I did is, number one, I'm very comfortable in the Wall Street cadence and public company. I also will never work for a company again that isn't on a big growth trajectory that has been validated by quarterly earnings.
Right.
Right. And so at Splunk, most folks don't realize what rarefied air we're in right now at Splunk. I mean, growing 40%+ year over year at $2 billion in revenue is rarefied air.
Yeah.
Very few software companies have ever gotten to this altitude. And yet we have still so much more headroom, right? And so I think growing up at Dell, I am most comfortable in the, hey, we're a teenager and we need to get to fully grown adult stage as far as my skill set is concerned, and getting to rapid growth and massive scale is my happy spot versus being pre-IPO. But that's super important to me from the type of company I want to work for. The other thing is, back to that comment about who you work for matters. The human beings I work for matter more than anything. And the culture around the leadership team and the whole company matter. So I will never, ever again work for a company where inclusion and diversity are actually at the forefront of our culture. And we live it every day versus just talking about it and writing it on the wall. I will never work for people who aren't wonderful humans at their core first, outside of work.
I love it. Yeah.
So Doug and Susan and I spent a lot of time interviewing, and I asked for more dinners and more meetings and more meetings before I met anybody else at Splunk, because I wanted to make sure that the three of us really were on the same page as humans.
Right.
Right. Because it gets gnarly and messy and stressy at the E-staff level in any company. And so knowing that you all to some degree see the world the same way, or, I have young kids and I needed to know that that was okay with Doug and Susan, because there are moments where I'm going to have to step out of something important to go take care of my kids. But then I can be back on at midnight if I need to. Right. And that's not okay with some CEOs. That is okay with others. And they've been incredibly gracious to me, and to the point that 3 days into my tenure here, my dad had an emergent heart issue and had to go home for his surgery. And he didn't make it past 2 days post-surgery, and that was not expected. And the way that Susan and Doug and this organization treated me for the 3 weeks I took off after that to take care of my mom and get things in order was just beyond belief. They were so amazing to me, and I'd only been on the payroll for 3 days. And it just reaffirmed to me that I made the best decision I've ever made in my career to come to Splunk, not only because it's an amazing company, but because I'm working for the right people. And it makes me want to work even harder to make this company a success.
That's a lot on your plate all at once when you just joined the company. How did you get through that? And is there any, you mentioned that Doug and Susan were helpful in that. How'd you get through it?
Everybody believes in different things. I believe in God, but I will tell you that I think God put me in Susan's organization for a reason, many reasons. She lost her dad a little over a year ago and was very close to him, much like I was with mine. My dad was my best friend and mentor, as well as being my dad. So if there's one person who had walked a mile in those shoes who really understood, it was her. And so that was amazing. But my team gave me a little bit of space to kind of get my footing. And they all gave me a little bit of runway to get ramped into here, probably more than normal, which is not how I like to start. I like to be fast and furious in life. And, you know, I needed a little bit of time to get my sea legs again, which I've got back. And I think it's important to figure out what it takes. Each person's different, right? But for me, focusing on the priorities in life and getting back to the basics on what really matters versus what's just noise. Mm-hmm. My friend, Shannon Brayton, who's a CMO at LinkedIn, she and I have kids in the same classes, and she's one of my first friends in the Valley. But she always said to me, know your non-negotiables. And it should only be 2 to 3 things, but you should not negotiate on those. And I feel the same way about life, like ruthless prioritization. And this brought me into very clear focus about what that is. And also I think just remembering every day, like having gratitude. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have had a wonderful life so far and I'm very grateful. It hasn't been without its lumps, but every night go to bed thinking about the good stuff. And I think that accelerates healing for sure.
When it comes to building your marketing team here at Splunk, I'm curious, how are you thinking about building that team? And you mentioned earlier, you know, marketing is basically building a subculture inside a larger culture. Mm-hmm. How's that going?
So I had the great privilege of inheriting a pretty healthy marketing team here. So that's not always the case when companies are searching for new CMOs. And oftentimes, I'm sure you know, but the CMO role is about the shortest tenure in the Valley.
Yeah, new HBR report shows it's dropping from, I think, 18 months to maybe less than that now. Yeah, so
it's crazy.
Not good.
Yeah, it's not good. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. But I think misalignment between CMOs and CEOs and COOs during the interview process is a big part of that. As a consequence, marketing orgs get thrashed because they have new leaders all the time. And it's really hard for people to find their footing when they don't have some stability at the leadership layer. So my number one job when I got here was to take all these talented people and just lay bare the fact that I'm a human being too. And I'm here to listen, I'm here to learn, but I'm also here to help them get to their very best version of themselves and collectively as a team. I truly believe in Pat Lencioni's book, The Advantage, where they talk about, or he talks about smart and healthy orgs are the ones who really succeed. And health, it's very crucial that health means a lot of things, you know, transparency and clarity and a leadership team that actually works together versus against each other. And so I've been working very hard to sit down and figure out what, you know, make minimal change to the team because that's thrashy, but the changes that are necessary in the first 6 months so that we can set it and move forward knowing that this is how we will stabilize for the future. And for, you know, FY21 will be the big year of like major movement and contribution from a marketing perspective.
Right.
And we needed this year to sort of sort through, where are we spending money that's smart? Where are we spending money that's not? What does the ROI look like on everything that we're putting in market? And are we under-resourced in areas of headcount? And turns out our product marketing was really under-resourced compared to product management that had bulked up in the last year and compared to our field sales, which had bulked up. And all of a sudden they were getting squeezed. So getting that right-sized and just all the basic blocking and tackling and hygiene of an organization is going on so that we can then go do our best work and go from, you know, $1 and $15 out of pipeline to $1 in and get to 28 to 30 in the not too distant future, because that's what I'd like to be doing.
What type of campaigns did you inherit? So I've seen a number in the Wall Street Journal and other places. I love the feel. It's arresting. It catches your vision. But what campaigns did you inherit, and any ones that you can talk about now?
All of our creative for the most part is done in-house. And I have to say the creative team is pretty brilliant. There's the Embrace Data Chaos campaign that came last year, and then the Dark Data Report that came out, I believe, in April. So you'll see some stuff coming in the not too distant future that's going to crystallize who we are in our next phase of growth as a company and what we offer the market. I think, you know, back to the fact that we're $2 billion-ish in revenue, we're probably one of those brands that the fewest people know of that are actually $2 billion in revenue.
Right.
And part of that is because we're a very technical product that, you know, data centers love and IT geeks love and security and CISOs and CIOs. But if you don't run in that lane, you may not have always heard of Splunk. And so our intent is to educate the broader market on who Splunk is, because the reality is we believe most problems are ultimately data problems. And Splunk solves data problems. And we allow you to get to your data real time, pretty much wherever it lives, and then go solve for those data problems. And so you're going to see our messaging coalescing around that concept.
And I'll be excited to watch that evolution. I think that your podcast campaigns are going great, though. Just want to let you know.
Awesome.
Just a heads up.
Great.
Full disclosure. Yeah, full disclosure. That's
thank you.
Partly us, but yeah, yes. we're really excited for that. What tips do you have for us when we're out, you know, creating and representing the Splunk brand? Mm-hmm. We're obviously like trying to learn as fast as we can and prepare. Any type of guidance or maybe like your brand guidelines that you have that you like to talk about?
Yeah, you know, look, I'll give you some meta level ones. I'll give you some guardrails. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as we launch the new branding, I'd love to get in the weeds on the more specific guidelines. But I would say, number one, we're not just a technology company. Like, again, if you look at what's going on in the world, just about every problem needs some sort of data to solve it, right? Whether it's human trafficking or global warming, whatever, even if it's, you know, I don't want to get political, but election hacking. I mean, there's data out there that we can't get our hands on, back to the dark data. The mm-hmm. reality is so much of an organization's data is not accessible, not visible. And we all need to know what's going on in order to solve for it. We can't manage what we cannot measure.
Right.
And so Splunk is so much bigger than what people have previously known us as. And as we're expanding our portfolio and our innovation curve is ramping up in rapid speed, like back to why I came here, when I interviewed with Tim Tully, he told me they had hired like 350 engineers in the last year in the Valley.
Wow.
I about choked. I mean, no one does that, right? Unless you've got an incredible roadmap, really sexy ideas that are coming to fruition, and an incredible leader leading that organization. And so I thought, you know, that's where I want to be. I want to be at this place where we're going to be hiring at scale some crazy talent so that we can take this technology to the next level and beyond. And so that's going to be, for our brand, it's really elevating it right mm-hmm. now. And I know people say that, but truthfully, we've been in the bowels of the data center and kicking butt. I mean, no pun intended, but we need to be where CEOs understand that we are their best friend mm-hmm. and CISOs know that as well. And we are used for much broader use cases and applications that we're being used for today. But I think the world needs to understand that.
Yeah. And I think that everybody out there that's listening that might be interested in Splunk, that's the type of thing that I know pushes many people over the edge from being interested to getting more info, because, you know, with 350 engineers, that's a lot. So any org and CTO that are putting together that level of campaign and project, that's really exciting.
And those are just net new in the last year on top of the engineers we already had. So like
wild.
We have this crazy large organization that is doing great work.
What type of mediums are you most excited about now? Or is it mm-hmm. video? Is it audio? Is it VR, AR? Or is it just classic, you know, digital?
You know, it's interesting. As moving to the Bay, I'm a commuter now. And my only quiet time in my life, because I have two young people and a brand new puppy and an organization at Splunk, is during my commute, right? So I think a lot of people actually feel the same way. And so I love audio. And I feel like the world is gravitating towards audio, and even just books that I want. I used to have a stack of books on my nightstand and I just blow through them every night. I don't have that luxury anymore. And so I listen to books like literally while I'm on the road. I listen to podcasts. But I find that audio has had a renaissance because of all the commute lifestyle that we're all in these days, whether it be on a train, in your car, what have you. I literally bought the car that I bought in the last year. And I'm not a car person, because the software was so good.
Yeah,
because
just based
on the
car player.
I wanted a one-click Apple CarPlay so I could just listen to stuff without being distracted on the road.
Yeah.
And I literally bought the car, and within 10 minutes of seeing it, I was like, okay, this car I want. Software's great. Let's go. Like, I have no idea. Like, I got the car home. My husband was pressing buttons. He's like, do you have massagers in your front seat? I was like, I don't know. He's like, you do? Like, I had no idea. Because I just wanted the software.
Yeah,
so,
very cool.
Yeah.
So we like to call podcasts and audio, it's basically augmented reality that works. It doesn't require mm-hmm. extra tinkering or anything to set up, doesn't require a new device, but you can do more while you're learning or while you're getting information. So are there any favorite audio sources that you mentioned, you know, audiobooks, any good books come to mind, any good podcasts that you're listening to lately?
Yeah. So I will say again, and I know a lot of people have read this book, but I just think if you're a leader and you're trying to curate great leadership dynamic, The Advantage is literally one of my favorite books. I just, you know, I think The Five Dysfunctions of a Team are also good by Lencioni. I'm sort of a Lencioni believer, but I truly think The Advantage is a non-starter for any leader.
Okay.
I think even early stage leaders, like the thing you forget about is curating a healthy dynamic, and you don't talk about the tough stuff in the team meeting rooms. You talk about it in back channel, and it causes this erosion of your org. Like
right.
that, the, what they teach you and the practical steps on how to run staff meetings and things of that nature, I just find like I've reread it again, and we're about to train on it here with my leadership team at Splunk. And I did that at Box. That's the number one I'd go read. And then I listen to stuff that's not work related. I'm a World War II history freak.
Oh,
and
cool.
So yeah. I do a lot of that just because, and I read about dog training because I've got a 6-month-old unruly puppy. So here we go.
And speaking of your German Shepherd puppy, could you introduce them maybe?
Yeah.
So yeah. When'd you get him?
He came home on Friday, actually. We lost our last dog a year ago Friday on my daughter's 5th birthday, sadly. So we brought home the new one on my daughter's 6th birthday. And he is a 6-month-old therapy trained German Shepherd, so he'll be able to do nursing home therapy in the not too distant future, which I'm pumped about. It's another side passion of mine. It's a very neglected portion of our population in the States. So if I can put a plug in, go visit
an
elderly human sometime soon and, you know, tell them you appreciate them. They need to hear that.
Cool. Check it out.
Yeah. Thor Elizabeth is his name. My 9-year-old son, my 9-year-old son got the first name, and my 6-year-old daughter got the middle name. And it was almost Thor Churro, as I think I explained earlier, but became Thor Elizabeth, and it suits him.
Are there any tips you have for leaders that are listening to this interview right now and thinking about how do I uncover dark data? How do I make my org more of a data-driven org? Any high-level tips?
I literally, just about everywhere I go in a new job, I make sure that, number one, before I sign onto a new company, that the CEO, the COO are supportive of me hiring data analysts and data scientists. Some don't believe that needs to sit in marketing. And my belief is that you typically have a centralized org that has the Bible, if you will, of the company data, but analyzing that through a marketing lens is a whole discipline. And you need someone, if they're pitching that data to you, you need somebody who can catch it. And so you need some folks embedded in marketing. I firmly believe that. It doesn't need to be an army of people, but you need some folks to do that. And it's just as much human talent as it is technology. So whether you're working with Splunk or whether you have Tableau with that or what have you, you're going to have a set of tools that will surface the data for you. But you need people who strategically can glean insights and make recommendations on that. And so for me, it's super important to understand this is human and science put together and technology and people. And so you need to find great people, reward great people, make sure they know that they're important to the organization and not a footnote to it. And today's strategy, analytics and data and insights are at the forefront of any organization I curate and lead, and they make me better. And I would tell a leader that if you're not at least twice a week getting in the weeds on data with your team, you're missing it because data things are moving fast. So I like to have a basic dashboard set up, you know, within the first few months of working somewhere where when I open my system every day, I can see the top metrics that I need to understand. And my team knows that if something's sideways, what I want to know is like text me immediately if, you know, there's something that's off the rails so that you can get on it because things are going to happen, right? And the business isn't always going to be a well-oiled machine, but how you respond to it, how quickly you get on top of it, surface it, talk about it, learn from it, and truly fail fast is going to be the difference between the org succeeding and not succeeding. And data is going to be at the base of that.
And when you're talking with your other friends that are SVPs of marketing or CMOs here in the Valley, are there any themes that you notice about other CMOs facing similar challenges? Or do you continually hear the same story? Or what's that like when you're talking with them?
Yeah, I will say, I think the thing that surprised me most about the Valley in a pleasant way is that it's a very fraternal place.
Right.
And so I was introduced to a bunch of CMOs in the Valley when I first got here, and they have remained friends, allies, trusted advisors, the whole thing. And we share a lot. And there's a very consistent theme with it's not just about your brand anymore or about your comms. It's truly about the performance of the business. And marketing in most companies has a very legitimate seat at the table and a significant seat in many cases. And so the onus as far as being a P&L contributor is massive. But what's interesting is CMOs right now have come up in different functions, right? We all come up in different swim lanes because there's so many functions within marketing. Some of them came from product marketing, some of them in brand, some of them in comms. I have friends who came up through comms and had never done demand gen, and all of a sudden they're a CMO of a big company, right? And so how do you solve for that? And one of my friend's best pieces of advice was do reverse mentoring, right? Go to the very bottom of your organization and sit with your SEO manager and have them mentor you once a week for 30 minutes, right?
And again,
putting your ego at the door and learning, right? This is about how do we as a team get collectively better? And none of us can be completely expert in every discipline in marketing every day of the week.
Right.
And so hire great people, learn from great people, and check your ego at the door.
Very cool. And when it comes to working with Susan and Doug, they've been guests and I loved interviewing them, learned a lot. How are you all thinking about aligning sales and marketing here at Splunk?
I think the fact that I work for Susan should probably say a lot in and of itself. And I'm so thrilled to work for her. She's an amazing leader and also a really good human. But I would say that she is the lifeblood of this company behind Doug, and a lot of the success that Splunk has seen in the last 3 years have been she and Doug combined, right? Just really plowing through this. And her go-to-market vision is amazing and shrewd and on point. So I love being that. And the reality is we aren't a marketing org. We're part of a greater GTM org. Mm-hmm. And as such, that's customer success, which is wildly important, especially as we're transitioning more to being a cloud first company, right? And then also, partners and channel and then sales, right? And so if we're not all highly functioning together, this company won't be a $5 billion company in the distant, short term, which we hope we will be and can see pretty clear line of sight to getting there.
Yeah. So the one theme from Susan's interview was just like the global scope of how she was thinking about everything. Yeah. How are you thinking about emerging markets? And because Splunk is already a global product, but how are you thinking about expansion there? Any early things you can share?
Could we go harder in Chile? Yes, I'm sure we could. Does it make more sense to make sure that every asset we have is translated in German and multiple localizations there? Absolutely, because the market opportunity is larger. Mm-hmm. So where do you go first versus where do we need to go in totality? Two very different questions. But I think the usual suspects, right? Like Japan, France, Germany, big from a localization and international priority perspective, but LATAM's heating up for us. And I just see so many different markets. The good news is we're in a technology area that the whole world needs, and half of them don't know they need it yet, right?
Right.
And so it's like, it isn't one of those things that we're scratching and clawing for a declining market share. We can't get to the market fast enough. So how do we prioritize so that my team of, roughly 200 people is spending every hour wisely on the biggest opportunity short term and then building the long tail. So, stay tuned for the long tail, but, part of that is geographic markets. And part of that is how folks actually consume Splunk,
right?
And how we monetize that and what that motion looks like.
Any final words, thoughts, or stories you want to leave our listeners with?
10 years ago, I didn't know I wanted to be a CMO. I knew I wanted to be a marketer and I wanted to be a damn good one. And I wanted to be successful and contribute and be a great team player. And I then had some mentors kind of say that I needed to go hard into the leadership lane because that was where my towering strength was with people. But I didn't really want the hassle of it. And they said, no, it's time to kick you out of the nest. And it was the greatest favor anybody has ever done me, because the moment I really went headlong into leading larger teams, I found my footing and my passion. And my career took off. And so I would just say, you don't have to know everything as a millennial or at age of 25 about what you want to be in the future. That can ebb and flow over the course of your career, but have the guts to dive in even when you're not ready. Take risks. What's the worst that can actually happen? I mean, my career has taken off and been the most rewarding when I've done things that have been really hard, right? The gnarly job that nobody wanted. I mean, there's a reason why Box gave me the offer when I'd never been a CMO before, is because sitting CMOs didn't want that job at the time, right? But you take something that looks gnarly and you make something beautiful of it, and it can be the greatest experience of your career.
Carrie, I love that. That's a great place to end the interview. We'll see everybody next time. Mission Daily and all of our podcasts are created with love by our team at mission.org. We own and operate a network of podcasts and a brand and story studio designed to accelerate learning. Our clients include companies like Salesforce, They're a Customer Times 5, Twilio, and Katerra, who work with us because we produce results. To learn more and get our case studies, check out mission.org/studios. If you're tired of media and news that promotes fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and if you want an antidote to all that chaos, you're at the right place. Subscribe here and to our daily newsletter at mission.org. Each morning, you'll get a newsletter that will help you start your morning and your day off right.
Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning into this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. It helps spread the word, and I would greatly appreciate it. See you next time.